Members, I call the meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We have a full agenda and a full room today. I just want to make sure, I know there's people who want to come in to sit. If you are going to testify on any of the bills, I would ask, or give a moment here where there's some chairs behind the testifiers' table, that if people want to go there and sit, and then that might allow for some new folks to come in who are waiting outside. We're going to try to stay on time today. We have a lot of testifiers available. We have some business today at the beginning. Earlier this, was it this week or last week? Oh, we better do the minutes first. So Representative Anderson, Co-Chair Anderson, have you reviewed the minutes?
I have and I do.
Co-Chair Anderson moves the minutes from March 9th, 2026. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay? Ayes have it. Minutes are adopted. Co-Chair Anderson and I had talked about the veterinary medicine bill, House File 3718. We were waiting on a fiscal note. The fiscal note came back without any fiscal consequence. So we would like to move that bill out. Chair Anderson, would you like to move House File 3718 be referred to the General Register? As amended?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, we had a hearing a week ago on it, a lot of positive testimony. And yes, the fiscal note came back with no impact. So thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3718 as amended to the General Register.
Any questions from members? Co-Chair Anderson renews his motion that House File 3718 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye. Opposed say nay. Ayes have it. The motion prevails. Thank you. First up, we have House File 3965 by Representative Tabke. Sale and use of paraquat dichloride prohibited. We estimate this will go till about 1:45. We are going to give testifiers 2 minutes during the presentation. So I will move House File 3965 to bring it before the committee. Representative Tabke, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and Co-Chair Anderson as well. Thank you very much, everyone, for allowing us to hear this really, really important bill today. Over a million folks in the United States are afflicted with a disease called Parkinson's that I think folks are very familiar with. It has been directly linked to a chemical called paraquat. And so paraquat is a very, very minimally used chemical in the state of Minnesota. And we are hoping that we will move this bill forward today to ban the use of paraquat in the state of Minnesota. And so paraquat is a knockdown vegetation. So it is used on cover crops, and it's used to knock down vegetation, but it's very, very minimally used in the state of Minnesota again. So this would not affect very many folks. And it also has been, it's manufactured by Syngenta. Syngenta has announced, coincidentally, the day that we dropped this bill, that they are no longer manufacturing paraquat. And so it is manufactured in England. England has banned the use of paraquat. Syngenta, owned by China. China has banned the use of paraquat. And so this is something that the vast majority of countries across the United, across the world have banned this use. And so just to give you a little example, 500 meters is between a third and a half mile or so. It has been proven that within 500 meters of paraquat being sprayed on a farm or anywhere that it's used, within 500 meters, you are 2 times more likely to get Parkinson's. And so I'm surrounded by folks, and you're in the audience today, are folks who are suffering from Parkinson's, and many of them could have been prevented if we had banned paraquat in Minnesota previously. And so I appreciate everyone listening and everyone hearing, and make sure to please listen to the stories of folks who are going to be in front of you today to talk about Parkinson's and how we can prevent this insidious, terrible disease.
We're going to hear a testimony. First up, Dan Feehan from the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hansen. My name is Dan Feehan.
proceed.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hansen, Co-Chair Anderson, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 3965, which would prohibit the use and sale of the herbicide paraquat in Minnesota. My name is Dan Feehan, and I am the Chief Policy and Government Affairs Officer for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. I want to take a moment to acknowledge and thank the members of the Parkinson's disease community that are here with us today and who have taken the time to come to the Capitol to support Minnesota banning paraquat. If you know someone with Parkinson's disease, you know it takes an enormous effort to do something that small to come to a place in public to talk about it. Parkinson's is a progressive disease that affects movement and can cause tremor, slowness, stiffness, and walking and balance problems. Non-movement symptoms such as depression and memory challenges are also part of many people's experience with Parkinson's. More than 1 million Americans live with Parkinson's today, and 90,000 new diagnoses happen each year. It is the fastest growing neurological disease in the world to date. And while we understand where Parkinson's come from to a certain degree, it has a genetic component. Environmental exposures play a significant role in disease risk. And among those environmental factors, the science linking the use of paraquat specifically to a significantly increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease is some of the most concerning and well-established science. Paraquat is a toxic chemical that is used as an herbicide. Decades of research have shown that people who work with or live near where paraquat is applied have a higher risk of developing Parkinson's. Research also shows that individuals who handle paraquat are about twice as likely to develop the disease compared to those using other pesticides. This is not an abstract risk. It affects farmers, farm workers, and families in rural communities across Minnesota. While paraquat continues to be used in the United States, much of the world has responded to the known public health risk that this herbicide poses. More than 70 countries, including the entire European Union, Brazil, and China, have banned the use of paraquat. Many of these countries, such as China, manufacture paraquat and export it to the United States, all while banning its use in their own backyard. This reveals a stark reality for all of us. Other governments protect their citizens from paraquats while profiting from its use here. In Minnesota, more than 21,000 people are currently living with Parkinson's. The direct and indirect costs, such as lost productivity, caregiving, disability, and household expenses, are estimated to be nearly $1 billion per year, much of which is borne by the taxpayer. An increase in Parkinson's prevalence represents a substantial public health and economic risk to the state. With this legislation, Minnesota has an opportunity to lead the nation and join much of the world by becoming the first state to prohibit the use and sale of paraquat. This is not the first time this has happened before. There are many other examples of chemicals where states have established the momentum and need to ban a substance. On behalf of the Michael J. Fox Foundation and the Resilient Parkinson's community we are proud to work with, I strongly urge the members of this committee to act on this legislation that will ban the use of paraquat and protect the health of Minnesotans. Thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. We'll take questions at the end of all the testifiers. Next up, Roberta Niver, a patient advocate.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Roberta Niver. I live in Burnsville. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's when I was 43 years old. While raising three boys who were 6, 9, and 12, like many people, I thought Parkinson's could only happen to people late in life. I never imagined it would happen to me. I'm now 67 and have lived with Parkinson's for over a third of my life. It's a cruel, progressive brain disease that slowly takes your independence, how you move, speak, and live day to day. It also deeply affects the people who care for you. I do not have any genetic factors for Parkinson's disease. My doctors have told me my diagnosis was influenced by an environmental exposure. I may never know the exact cause, but I do know the impact the disease has on a person and their family. I share my story because you have an opportunity in front of you today. There's even a chance to prevent another Minnesotan, another parent or family from going through this. It's worth taking action. And we know there's a chance because Decades of research show a clear link between paraquat and Parkinson's. I urge you to support this bill that would ban paraquat and help protect all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Lisa Erickson, patient advocate. Welcome. State your name for the committee.
Lisa Erickson. Honorable Chairs Hansen and Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to support HF 3965, the bill to ban paraquat. With robust scientific evidence that links this toxic herbicide with a person's risk of developing Parkinson's, I earnestly ask your support. I live in Edina, have two sons who spent their formative years here, and have been a proud resident of Minnesota for 13 years. I come to you on behalf of the Parkinson's Foundation, where I serve as a board member for the Minnesota and Dakotas chapter, and as a person with Parkinson's. My journey with Parkinson's began last year with a diagnosis after experiencing tremors in my legs and my hands, increasing difficulty walking, and substantial fatigue and anxiety, among other symptoms. These conditions made it difficult for me to continue the career I loved in helping people to reach their financial goals, and ultimately I had to cease working. My story is only one of the million plus Parkinson's patients who adjust or even give up ways they serve in their careers, at home, and in their community because of this disease. Our journey is made more complex because everyone's Parkinson's is different, it's an idiosyncratic disease, and the combination of symptoms changes over time. The uncertainty and unpredictability of this disease gives it an extra edge. Since there is no cure for Parkinson's yet, prevention is key. Paraquat is widely associated with Parkinson's, and 70 countries have banned it. Since there is no restriction federally on the use of this chemical, I strongly ask for your support of HF 3965. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you. And I prepared too much to say, so I'm going to try and condense and kind of fly. My name is Deb Hoganson. I was married for 49 years and 10 months to a wonderful man who farmed. His name was Douglas Bauman. He passed away in 2023 of Lewy body's dementia, which is an atypical form of Parkinson's disease. It is one of the more common forms of dementia, not well understood even within the medical community. It was hard for Doug and I to find assistance, to get a diagnosis. Our primary care physician discounted the idea that he had a dementia because he could still add numbers. But Doug used to do complex math equations in his head because he was brilliant with numbers. We finally got help through the Mayo Clinic. I had to push to get Doug accepted into their, they only accept so many patients for in their dementia group a year. And I did, because I'm professionally in my work, I was a social worker and a case manager for people with intellectual disabilities. So I knew how to push bureaucracies. I got Doug accepted within the first 90 minutes of his first exam. They told us, you have Lewy body's dementia. I had never heard of it. But when I read about it, it just nailed every symptom Doug had. It was terminal. It was going to be a difficult road, because with Lewy body's dementia, you also get the added benefit of psychosis. That's one of the symptoms that comes with that disease. There are medications that help. They help the brain work around the damage in the brain. So, you know, Doug would say, you know, when you take the meds, oh, I feel it clicking in. And he would get sharper. Through the years and working with people, I have found that our situation was unusual. Most families lived with the disease and no answer for years. So they lost all, the meds stopped working after a while. So they lost all those years of a better quality of life unnecessarily because too many of our primary care doctors don't know enough about this disease. So one of the things that you have on one of the bills is for a trust fund, and I'm hoping part of that will help increase community knowledge and medical knowledge of the disease. As I said, Doug was a farmer. He farmed for over 40 years. He was born on a farm. As I understand it, the chemical Paraquat was used more in the past. It's a high probability that Doug was exposed either in his childhood or as he farmed. Nobody should have to waste their life with that disease and the damage that it does to them and to their families. And I guess I'm done. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. Next up, Marty and Pat Ryan. Patient and caregiver. Marty and Pat Ryan. Then Morgan Schaefer, Clean Water Action. Welcome. State your name for the committee.
Thank you. Morgan Schaefer. Good afternoon, Chair Hansen, Co-Chair Anderson, members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. And thank you to Representative Tabke for carrying this bill. My name is Morgan Schaefer, and I'm an organizer with Clean Water Action Minnesota. I have a degree in environmental science, and before joining Clean Water Action, I worked in a lab conducting water quality testing for the state of Wisconsin. I'm here today to ask that this committee vote in favor of HF 3965 to ban paraquat dichloride sale and use in Minnesota. Paraquat dichloride is an extremely potent, non-selective herbicide used in industrial agriculture. Paraquat works by generating something called a reactive oxygen species in plants and animals. In plants, this disrupts photosynthesis, or the process that makes plants green and keeps them alive. In just hours, plants are left dead and desiccated. In animals and humans, reactive oxygen species cause intense cellular damage. Long-term low levels of paraquat exposure is linked to Parkinson's disease, childhood leukemia, and more. The mortality rate of acute paraquat poisoning is between 50 and 90%. This chemical is especially dangerous because its application often involves some sort of spraying, during which it is very difficult to ensure that all of the product stays within its desired boundaries. In fact, paraquat dichloride can be picked up by wind and distributed to land and water. Think back to what paraquat targets, the green parts of plants. Think about areas surrounding our agricultural production land. There's a lot of green there, not to mention the people working and living around these lands. All of that has the potential to be impacted by paraquat use. Less harmful and effective alternatives exist and are being used all over the world. 70 countries, including China and Brazil and the European Union, have banned this chemical, and I ask that you add Minnesota to this list today by voting in favor of House File 3965. Thank you.
Thank you. Lee Helgen, Minnesota Crop Production Retailers.
May I have Tim join me as well?
Yes.
Chair.
Welcome. State your name for the record.
I'm Lee Helgen. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We're the agricultural co-ops and retailers who would sell a product like this to our customers. We also have the license applicators who may be involved with spraying the product out there, have the licenses and the additional training to safely administer the paraquat product. We think it's an effective weed control material and that we should maintain that as a product available for sale in Minnesota, It's particularly useful for hard-to-control weeds, maybe in no-till and conservation tillage situations where you need to kind of dry out a crop so you can plant. And we continue to support a science-based approach to maintaining products available here in Minnesota. With me, I have Tim Brown, who could speak some more.
Mr. Brown, welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Name is Tim Braun, and I'm a farmer in the Princeton area. Here representing farmers across the state of Minnesota, as well as a career agronomist in the crop protection business. So I am a water quality certified farm. I am very appreciative of the work the legislature has done to encourage such things. I've implemented no-till, strip-till, and cover crops on my farm, which comes as a challenge. It changes the status quo. It changes how you operate your business. So one of the things when I saw that the potential ban of paraquat was on the table, it kind of scared me a little bit. So I have a lot of experience as a mechanic as well, working on my own farm equipment and stuff like that. And I have a pretty large toolbox sitting in my shop, right? And there's some pretty specific tools in there that I can only use for certain things. Paraquat is a very important tool in that toolbox. Now, do we use it on every acre all the time very consistently? No, we try to avoid it because we understand that it's no fun to handle. It's dangerous as far as that goes for those of us applying it. But when I need to go burn down some nasty weeds in my no-till environment where I don't want to take a disc or a ripper or anything through there and disturb the soil, causing erosion, things like that, having a tool like paraquat is great. When I want to go burn down some cover crops, especially in a cool spring, things like that, I need that tool in my toolbox if I want to continue using that good environmental practice. With paraquat, it's been well regulated by the EPA. It's determined that, in its use form, it is quite safe. Its closed-loop handling is required, so applicators, operators, things like that cannot be exposed to it due to the way handling is. You can't even physically open a jug of paraquat anymore. It has to be done through a closed-loop system that dumps it right into the sprayer to avoid any kind of handler contact with the product. The other thing is there's buffers required around residential areas due to the fact that we don't want people exposed to it, right? So between a 50 and 75 foot buffer is on the label away from residential areas. It's not allowed to be sprayed near parks, golf courses, things like that. It is already very well regulated. I ask that you guys please do not take this tool away from us farmers in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you guys.
Next up is a Zoom testimony from Deborah Swerdlow from the Parkinson's Foundation.
Yes, hi. Co-Chair Hansen, Co-Chair Anderson, and members of the committee. I'm Deborah Swerdlow, Associate VP of Advocacy and State Policy with the Parkinson's Foundation, and we strongly support HF 3965 to ban paraquat. A little bit about the Parkinson's Foundation. We work to improve care and advance research toward a cure. Here in Minnesota, we partner with dedicated volunteers, some of whom you've heard from today, and with a Parkinson's Foundation Center of Excellence, providing specialized multidisciplinary care and education to people across the state. We're also working to create a world where fewer people develop Parkinson's in the first place, and this starts with prevention, which HF 3965 addresses. As we've heard today, paraquat has been clearly linked to an increased risk of Parkinson's, and those who work in agriculture and live near farms face higher exposure and higher risk. I would also note that the burdens of Parkinson's disease are vast, costing our country billions of dollars and taking a tremendous emotional and financial toll on families, as we have heard today. And those economic effects really ripple throughout the community, whether it's the direct costs that Medicare is paying or the lost productivity from an unpaid care partner who must retire early, cut back their hours, or miss their own routine healthcare appointments to manage the complexity of caring for someone with Parkinson's. As the person before me testified, I certainly can't speak to the tools that are available to farmers, but, unfortunately, this is a tool that we know has pretty well-documented harms, and we also heard from other folks who testified that it's actually not in as widespread use as it used to be. So there are alternatives to this tool available. Over 70 countries, including the European Union and China, have already banned paraquat, and this bill would bring Minnesota's practices in line with the rest of the world and protect Minnesotans from a known health risk, which is why we urge you to pass HF 3965. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Tom Peterson, Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And Joshua Stamper, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. State your name for the record.
Thanks, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Tom Peterson, the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and appreciate the opportunity to just make some brief comments on it, and then have Mr. Stamper kind of talk about a little bit about what the department works on. Thank you, Representative Tabke, for discussion on the bill and everything. You know, when it first came up, it was kind of interesting because I thought, boy, we're really starting to phase out paraquat, and I started to look into it more and everything. And I, Mr. Stamper maybe has the numbers too, but we have increased what we use is still a lot less compared to other products. But we have seen an increase. In fact, I think we've doubled in 25 what we used in 24. And then digging a little further into that, kind of found what Mr. Braun said and talking to some of the farmers yesterday. I was at Centrosota annual meeting and, you know, just kind of asking farmers how they use it and then kind of around the area, you know, as a cover crop and what else would you use, you know, and everything. So I think as you get into this committee and the legislature and others, we've really tried to build that out and trying to get more regenerative practices, and we're seeing more farmers do that. But we're also seeing farmers, especially I'd say as you get north of here, as they try to terminate some of the cover crops, especially if it's a root like a turnip or a radish or something like that, that it can be quite difficult, and that is where they're continuing to use it. And so I think that is kind of interesting. One thought, I'm always not 100% sure on bans, because what is the other product then that folks are going to use if they can't use that, and how much of that are they going to use? And then the one thing I do appreciate in this bill is it, you know, goes out till 2027, and then looks like it has, you know, farmers could use existing stocks into 2028, if I read that right. And that's pretty standard when we do take something off the market or something, we allow that to go forward. I'd also say, I don't know if it's been brought up in discussion, but, even though Syngenta isn't making it right now, to me, it looks like there's still about 24 other off-brand, because the patent ran out, is my understanding, and companies that are still making it in some form. But Mr. Stamper will make some comments, and then we're glad to take any questions.
Mr. Stamper, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paraquat is a commonly used chemical in the South, specifically with more diverse cropping rotations and the need to terminate cover crops very rapidly. As a product, it has some of the most acute toxicity of any chemicals that we regulate. It is very, very not good for you. I think the reality is, though, that there is increasing use, especially as we have integrated more cover crops into Minnesota's agricultural landscape. There is an increasing need to control those and terminate those cover crops. With regards to the programs within pesticide and fertilizer management, there are adequate funds to handle any waste pesticides that would be returned if this bill was to pass. And we are finishing up the fiscal note and hope to have that to you very shortly.
Let me just check and see if there's anyone else in the audience who would like to testify before we go to questions. Yes, we have one more over here. Welcome, and if you can state your name for the record.
Hello, I'm Mark Kellum. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I was born in Red Wing, Minnesota, grew up working on my uncle's farm just outside of Lake City, Minnesota, and then took off to serve in our country's military in the Army. I am service-connected for young-onset Parkinson's with the VA. Some of my favorite years were with the Minnesota Army National Guard, 34th Infantry Division, 434th Chemical Company, Detachment 1. When I hear people talk about tools that can be used, I think back to helping out on my uncle's farm, and my military days. And when you say that this is a tool that can be used, a nuclear blast could actually eradicate quite well any foliage that seems to be a problem. Now, I know that seems like hyperbole, right? That's silly for me to even mention that. Well, how about Agent Orange, where 50% of the active ingredient of Agent Orange was a chemical known as 2,4-D? We no longer use it because we know what it does to the human body at the cellular level. For years, we kept it hidden, knowing the true damage that it did. Companies spent an enormous amount of money to allow it to continue to be used for their own greed. We don't have to do that anymore. We have plenty of tools in our resources that can be used. This is one that science has been clear on. We know the ban is coming, and so do they. Over 70 nations in the world have outright banned this. The two nations remaining that create this chemical won't even allow it to be used on their own lands or around their own people. And yet it's being sold here in my beloved Minnesota. And you have the power to be a leader, as Minnesotans often are in our nation, to say no more. There are other tools. The evidence is clear, for the most part, for what this does. If you say, okay, it doesn't cause Parkinson's, well, then we can list numerous other illnesses that it causes. For myself, I was 38 years old when my tremors began. I went to the University of Minnesota Neurology Department, went through all the testing to hear someone say to me, the good news is you don't have Lou Gehrig's. Woohoo! But we think you have young onset Parkinson's disease. I just got up and left. For 8 years, I sat in silence over this disease, not letting anyone know that I had it. I was ashamed of it. And then I came out swinging, fighting against this disease and going public and saying, yes, I have it. And I don't want anyone else to have it. I don't want anyone to have to struggle to hold their own child or pick up their grandchild. I want Minnesota to be a place where the chemicals we use aren't known carcinogens. You can talk about safety all that you want, but at some point, we have to say the danger is too great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? We'll open up to members' questions of any of the testifiers or to the author. Members, any questions? Representative Harder.
Whoops, need the mic. Thank you, Chair Hansen. This might be a question for the department. So it talks about the collection and disposal. Can you just share with the group here how that would roll out if this passed? Thank you.
Mr. Stamper, do we need to repeat the question, or did you hear it?
Would you please?
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. The question was that if this bill passed, can you just tell the group here how that rollout would work in terms of collection?
Mr. Chair, representatives, the waste pesticide program has collected and safely disposed of 7 million pounds of pesticides since its beginning. If this bill was to pass as it's amended, or as it is written right now, you would be able, like anyone who has the product could continue to use it this year, and then sales would cease next year, and then you would be able to continue to use it through next year. But then after that, it would be illegal to use Paraquat, and we have a waste pesticide collection program that would, at no charge to anyone who had the product, would take that product and then safely dispose of it through contractors.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So The collection, is that done at a state level, or do you roll that down to the counties through their departments?
Mr. Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I believe the number is 86 counties that we have a cooperative agreement with at their county hazardous waste facilities that farmers can just take it to whatever their nearest county facility is, and then they would accept that, and it's off their hands and off the market.
Representative Harder.
Okay, thank you, Chancellor. Okay, one more question. So if the product is collected, then it would come back to the state from the counties, then how does the state dispose of the product? That's my last question. Thank you.
Mr. Stamper.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I can't tell you chemically how it's done exactly for paraquat, but typically it's neutralized chemically and then incinerated.
Maybe, Mr. Stamper, that's an existing appropriation to the waste pesticide collection program. It would not require an additional appropriation this year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Co-Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Tabtee, thanks for the bill. You have some testifiers that are certainly get your point across, and I appreciate that a great deal. As was mentioned, banning anything is kind of a big deal, and I'm not quite sure that today I'm ready to go along with that, although we're certainly going to talk more about it in the near future. If Mr. Stamper could come back up again, and Mr. Stamper, you know, we have a lot of directions and restrictions on chemicals. Went through and did restrictions on dicamba, another crop protection product that farmers use. Can you tell us any restrictions there may be on the purchase, sale, or the use of the product we're talking about today?
Mr. Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, paraquat is probably one of the chemicals with the most applicator health restrictions in there. It is a restricted use pesticide, meaning that you cannot, like most folks in this room, unless they have a commercial or a private pesticide applicator's license, would not be able to purchase this product. And there is specific training that folks who want to use paraquat have to go through to be able to use it. There was another testifier that talked about the closed system requirements, and that is specifically in there to reduce the risk, the occupational use risk of handling a lot of these chemicals. We know that it's really not good for folks, and there's a lot of restrictions that come along with that to limit occupational exposure.
Co-Chair Anderson.
Thank you again, and thank you, Mr. Stamper. Representative Tamke, I do have one question on one of the handouts from the Michael J. Fox Foundation. On the right-hand side, it says Parkinson's, and I'm not debunking any of these. I'm just asking a question. It says Parkinson's is the fastest-growing disease in the world that damages the brain. And yet one of your testifiers said it's already been banned in 70 nations. That probably is half the world. So if half the world has banned this chemical, I'm wondering why it's still the fastest growing chemical. Could you respond to that?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and Chair Anderson. I don't have that in front of me right now, but I do every year in the United States, there are 90,000 new diagnoses of Parkinson's in the United States of America. And so this is a chemical that, even though it is banned in many, many countries, it's still used, as happens oftentimes where people have leftovers, where have things going forward. And so it is something that we need to make sure that we're banning, and we're banning the manufacture, banning the sale here in the United States, so that even if we do ban it, there are people that will still have it, right, and be using it. And so as we talk through things and figure that out, we need to make sure that we're banning this today so that we use that supply up into the future and it's not available for anyone anymore. So there are 90,000 new diagnoses of Parkinson's every single year in the United States.
Co-Chair Anderson, I think the Michael J. Fox Foundation person is here who could answer that for you. So, Mr. Feehan?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Co-Chair Anderson, thank you for the question. The way I would answer it would be this. When we talk about exposure to the environment, we don't know a great degree of when that exposure then leads to Parkinson's and the time in between. So in the case of Parkinson's and Paraquat, is it when you were 5 years old, 35 years old? The manifestation of symptoms of Parkinson's don't have an instant timetable often. And so there's a degree of that. Secondly, Paraquat is not the only environmental contributor to Parkinson's disease, is the other piece of that. And so while these countries have made this action, it's difficult to parse out the difference alone of that when we know there are other environmental contributors. And the last thing I would say, in research terms, with mice, when researchers will try to demonstrate Parkinson's, they will literally use Paraquat in order to demonstrate that direct connection in scientific terms, the connection being that direct in and of itself. Okay.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would start by saying that if ever along the way we have really clear, unequivocal evidence of a chemical that's damaging our health, we're gonna have to move on it. And I know we looked at studies I checked out in advance of coming in here today. Even to this moment, we have some conflicting studies coming out about the safety and efficacy and, you know, are we really seeing this increased risk of Parkinson's? And the final summation was, it is at this point inconclusive. And I know these dear folks with Parkinson's, every one of these is a sad case. My uncle died of complications of Parkinson's after about a 20-year battle. Went and visited him, and he said, this would be great if I was fishing, but I'm not fishing right now. And he had a nice way of making humor, but it's a serious neuromuscular disease that eventually did take his life. But to my question, Commissioner Tom Peterson raised the same question or kind of casually mentioned it that I had in my mind, and that is, again, if it was really certainly evidently bad, we would stop it. But to the degree that there is some question, then it still enables us to ask the next question is, what would we replace it with? I know there's a pipeline probably spanning 20 years of good products that can come along and accomplish this purpose. My concern would be if you pull out of that pipeline too quickly, you know, pretty soon it's not going to be able to render the chemical compounds that you need to do it. And each of these products has a life cycle, right? They come on the market. I remember I was at a pharmacology class. I'll be so quick, I promise. The professor said, when a new medicine comes on the market, be sure you use it for all your patients immediately before it develops side effects. And that was a joke, because eventually these side effects will be known. They were intrinsic in the product the whole time, but you just didn't know about them until 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, they show up everywhere. Same in pharm chemistry, right? It looks good. There's something just waiting to go. We begin to use it on broad scale and find out it's not this utopia that we imagine, and we cycle to the next and next. The question then, have we gotten the benefit out of this chemical that we can get? And if not this, then what? And how confident are we of the safety of that?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and Representative Gander. So I'm going to ask Michael J. Fox Foundation to come up to talk about the specifics of the research on this. But as they're coming up, I would also address, like, there are alternatives. And so we know that glyphosate, for example, is number one alternative for killing off cover crops. Like, that's what is used most of the time. And if this is something that is necessary simply to kill radishes and turnips, which are important in cover crops, like that's a good thing. There are many other ways where we can do that. And I don't know if you farm or not, but there are many other ways that we can take out cover crops with mechanical practices, with other things to get that done, or the seed selections that we're choosing for those cover crops. And so there are a lot of ways that we can handle this, because the vast majority of the use, which is a very small use that is really impactful for folks who have Parkinson's, have gotten Parkinson's, and folks who don't have Parkinson's yet because of these excess exposure to these chemicals, it's really important that we stop that now before it becomes a problem. So, Mr. Chair, like the research guru here.
I'm going to give like five more minutes. I've got three more three more questions from members after that. So promptly.
Absolutely. Representative, I'd be happy to provide you with an overview of the scientific consensus on the subject if you're interested in. Like any subject, it's about establishing consensus. And consensus is just that. There will be outliers. There'll be points of disagreement on that. But we're trying to establish consensus. And over the course of decades, epidemiological studies and other biochemical studies have shown this linkage and connection on top of population studies that have shown people living near places where it's spread, including golf courses, have shown that connection. But would be happy to share those specifics with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate having the good scope of data. Thank you. Yes,
sir. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me, I'll be brief because I know we have a lot to do on today. Thank you to all the testifiers who came today. It seems to me that there is a consensus, as we just heard, that this chemical is harmful for humans, and yet the counter argument would be that we need to use this chemical for farming. And yet I think I keep coming back to this idea that we are behind the world in protecting our farmers from this chemical. This is banned around the world in many agriculturally based economies. Brazil, China, United Kingdom, Thailand, Switzerland, Vietnam have all banned this product. And so as we look at this bill, I just keep coming back to the question, why do farmers in China and Brazil and Canada and Thailand and Switzerland deserve more protection than farmers and people who live in our greater Minnesota area? And I think we would all agree they don't. Our Minnesotans deserve to be protected as well. So thank you for this bill, Representative Kapke.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going along with Representative Smith's statements, just kind of expand and really ask the question, who are we trying to protect here? Because, you know, paraquat is an industrial tool. We have heard how useful it is. And I would argue that the agriculture industry has the resources to protect themselves. They have the resources to pay lobbyists. They have the resources to get people to come here and testify on behalf of their shareholders. I would argue that we are tasked, each of us here, to protect people, the people that elected us. And so I do think this is just a question that we need to continue asking ourselves about this bill and about the future bills that we are going to hear in this committee, is who are we here to protect? Who are we here to serve? And I very much support this bill because I know why I'm here. I'm here to protect the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe for the agency, Mr. Stamper, this is my first time serving on the committee. And so can you tell us what is the purpose of a restricted use pesticide? Why is a chemical or why is a product labeled as a RUP?
Mr. Chair, representatives, restricted use pesticides is a designation that is applied by the EPA when something is especially dangerous due to its acute toxicity. Sometimes we designate products as restricted use because there is the risk that they could be used nefariously. There's been a lot of conversations about the revocation of registration and banning of use in other countries. This chemical has a long history of being used for suicide, and I think that plays a large role in the banning of it in foreign countries. Again, it's one of those chemicals that is so acutely toxic that it has a chemical in it that causes you to vomit immediately, and some people still don't survive that.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe just a comment and then a quick question to the agency. You know, really appreciate you sharing that, and I think that our government already know how bad this is for our body and for our people, and you know, we are by using the RUP, you know, we're legalizing putting bad chemicals out there that could potentially harm Minnesotans and all of us. And so can I just ask, you know, what is the agency's position on this bill? Are you for this bill or are you against this bill? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stamper, the commissioner wanted to take that. I think the commissioner's going to...
Mr. Chair, we don't have a position on this.
Representative Tabke, to close.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First off, thank you to all the folks that are sitting around us today who are suffering from this awful disease with humor and respect for each other. I don't know if you can see the shirts on folks, but there's a boxing club that gets together and boxes and makes sure that they're doing everything they can to keep their bodies healthy and working and moving forward. And we have the opportunity right now to keep more people from having to suffer this fate with them. It is something that we can do, something I believe that we should do. This is a chemical. This is a very easy bipartisan win that we could have for Minnesota. Like you heard the industry talk about the fact that this chemical has a 50 to 75 foot buffer from homes to be able to be using that. It's absolutely a tool in the toolbox for things, but a 50 to 75 foot buffer doesn't protect people from a 500 meter drift. It just doesn't protect people from a 500 meter drift. And this is something that it's nefarious. We don't know when people are exposed. We don't know how that happens, because you could just be, you know, driving down a gravel road and get there. Especially since my dad passed away, I'm much more active in farming operations than I was before. And we farm 1,400 acres in Northwest Iowa. And it is critical that we all continue to work in a direction that protects people, protects farmers. And this is one thing that we absolutely can do. So I ask that we move this forward today. If anybody wants to work together to move this forward, I would appreciate it. But I understand that we can wait for the fiscal note, which will be negligible and not have much impact. But I know that there's support on both sides for doing this. And this is something that we could use as a win for all of Minnesota. And when you turn around and look at all the people in this room, to give them a win in moving forward. So I just ask for everyone's support.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Just a couple quick comments for myself. Working in the department for many years and then being here, I've heard the tool in the toolbox more times than I would ever have tools. It's always the argument. But the tools that have to be purchased for this use are the canes and the crutches. They're the lifts and the chairs. Those are the tools that are purchased. And I think I would plead with my colleagues here. You know, we've heard the arguments. We hear them every year on everything. We're going to hear them on the next bill, too. To just say we could take this action, and we could take this action for, you know, I'll just ask again. I'll ask. We're going to take time here. We're going to lay this over. We're going to wait for the fiscal note. And I would hope to have this discussion, just to have that conversation, to ask if we can pass this bill. I'm not sure if we're going to pass much, Mr. Chair, but I would ask for that consideration, that I think this is something we can do. And I know it's different. The tools are always there. The tools are always here. But here's a tool we could take action that may actually have some direct impact on people. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I hope when we lay this over, we keep the conversation going. Co-Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We will keep talking. I didn't ask the question before, but what are other states doing? If we do this as a loner, and it's used in our neighboring states, I'd like to find out what's happening in other states, and we will keep talking. And, you know, the bill was introduced just a couple of weeks ago. Haven't had a lot of discussion on it yet. But I give you my word, Representative Tamke, that we will keep talking. And we have a couple of weeks left. And we can move this out if we feel it warrants that. But again, we thank you for bringing this forward. And thank you also to your testifiers.
Appreciate it.
Thank Representative Tamke, I think there's testimony going on in Missouri right now as well. So.
Yeah, there are, I think it's 13 or 14 other states that are in consideration right now. Minnesota would be the leader in this for sure. But there are 13 other states that are in consideration. Grant, Roberta's son, is with the Michael J. Fox Foundation. He's in Missouri right now testifying and has a good shot in many other places. So we could help be a leader and help other folks across the nation find ways to win.
I renew my motion that House File 3965 be laid over. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, everyone.
House File 3704, Representative Purcell, sale and distribution of certain seeds coated and treated with systemic insecticides. And we're running a little bit behind. That's my fault. I'll take full responsibility for that. So we might need to keep the testimony a little shorter. Representative Purcell, I will move House File 3704 to bring the bill before the committee. Representative Purcell, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I present House File 3704. This bill has more pages of testimony than any bill I have ever carried, and that's saying something. I encourage you to read the testimony in your packet. The level of expertise and research in these letters arguing for protecting human health, ecosystems, and water quality is truly impressive. Today, I return to the best committee with this legislation because I feel especially protective of the health of Minnesota's farmers, farm families, and our rural communities. This is a bill that puts reasonable constraints on use of neonic pesticides. According to Cornell College of Veterinary Medicine, quote, neonicotinoids can have both lethal and sublethal health effects. They interfere with the central nervous system. Clinical signs include incoordination, salivation, vomiting, pupil dilation, seizures, and other signs of neurotoxicity. Neonicotinoids can also impair reproduction and development, suppress the immune system, disrupt endocrine and kidney functions, and possibly increase cancer risk, unquote. The National Research Defense Council's testimony states that in Quebec, Canada, Quebec, Canada provides a highly successful model for eliminating the needless use of neonicotinoid seed coatings in field crops. In 2019, Quebec required farmers to obtain an agronomic justification, basically a prescription, before purchasing neonic-treated corn and soybean seeds. Within just 2 years, neonic-treated corn and soybean use was virtually eliminated and neonic contamination plummeted. Crucially, crop yields have remained constant or increased since the new restrictions. In 2025, Quebec expanded the program to all insecticide seed treatments consistent with the research showing that insecticide seed treatments in corn and soybeans generally do not benefit farmers. In 2024, New York and Vermont became the first states to pass bills to limit neonic-treated seed use following the success in Quebec. The provisions on those bills regarding restrictions on neonic field crop seed coatings will take effect on January 1st, 2029, and we can do it too. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm ready for our testifiers.
First up, we have Don Georgiev. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Don Georgiev. I am a retired faculty from the University of Minnesota, an internist, and I'm here to discuss the increasing amounts of data that and studies that are showing harmful effects of the neonicotinoids on human health. They've only been out in good use until 2010, so the data is rapidly accumulating of the toxicity to humans. Neonics, for short, are insecticides that kill or harm the insects by binding to and stimulating a receptor in the brain of the insects. And when the neonics were developed, it was thought that they only worked against the insects. However, many studies have shown that neonics are also toxic to mammals, as well as to insects. For example, studies have shown that rodents in the lab and deer in Minnesota exposed to neonics demonstrate decreased reproductive ability. And multiple studies have shown that exposing pregnant rats to neonics causes harmful effects to the brains and the mental behavior of their pups. Most concerningly, these effects are seeming to locate in the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that's important for development for memory for us as well as for the rats. But what data is available for humans so far? Since we can't feed pregnant women toxins and measure what happens, fortunately, we look to population studies to give us a clue about the toxicity, and these are coming in rapidly. There are multiple studies linking neonics to adverse health effects in reproductive ability, glucose metabolism, thyroid function, obesity, but I find most concerning the increasingly vast literature associating neonic exposure with adverse effects during pregnancy. Neonics are associated with more gestational diabetes, more preterm births, smaller babies with smaller heads. Studies have found that the risk of tetralogy of Fallot, which is a major...
Thank you.
I'm done?
Yep.
Oh! Okay.
Next up, David Legvold, Legvold Farms. And the next person is Steve Ellis. So if to save time, if you are the next testifier, go to a chair near the dock. A few seconds will save us time. Welcome. State your name for the record.
My name is David Legvold.
Go ahead.
I am a corn and soybean farmer from near Northfield. We have a 750-acre operation, and we just finished our 10-year certification as a Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certified Farm. The concern of soil health has been at the forefront of my thinking, and one of the indicators of healthy soil is a robust macroinvertebrate population. Neonicotinoids are devastating to soil macroinvertebrates as well as the avian population, which we all depend on for our foods. My experience with neonicotinoid chemicals is somewhat limited, but there's one event that stands out in my mind, and that was about 10 years ago. A seed purveyor told me that since I was out planting soybeans before the 1st of May, you'd better get them treated. And so I did. But I only treated one unit, which is about 2,500 pounds of seed. And then I planted regular seed right next to it. And the yield monitor of the combine tells the story. There was no difference in yield. There was no advantage, but I did spend several dollars per acre to treat the seed with no return on investment. And so I'm concerned that there's a waste of money. Secondly, the environmental impacts of neonicotinoids is concerning. So when we treat soybean seed and we run it through a planter, the planter is usually vacuum actuated. So there's a chamber on this side of this rotating disc where a vacuum pressure is applied, and these little divots on this side grab the soybean seed in a reservoir of tumbling seeds, and as they tumble, the seed coating is abraded, but it is pulled through and then exhausted into the field. And I don't know what the half-life of neonicotinoid chemicals is. I do know that it just doesn't seem a good thing to be broadcasting it out into the environment.
Thank you. Thank you. We have to move on.
My use of neonicotinoids and other seed treatments in soybeans has been zero. And I think the gold standard of how it works for me is we have not gone broke.
Thank you. Next up, Steve Ellis, Old Mill Honey Company. And then after him, Lee Helgen. Mr. Ellis, welcome, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Steve Ellis. For the past 45 years, I've owned and operated a migratory beekeeping operation called Old Mill Honey in Barrett, Minnesota. Over the past 25 years, I have served the beekeeping industry in a number of national and state capacities, advocating for beekeepers' interests with regards to pesticides, principally neonicotinoids. I have represented both national beekeeping organizations at meetings with USDA, EPA, and the chemical manufacturers such as Bayer. I was appointed by Governor Mark Dayton in 2016 to serve as the Governor's Committee on Pollination as a commercial beekeeping representative. Beekeepers in Minnesota have been on the record with concerns with neonicotinoid-treated seeds from the year that they first started in the 1990s. In 2004, six commercial beekeepers filed a class action lawsuit against Bayer, known as when it was still a gaucho-treated seed, which is a registered product, unlike today, Bauer versus Bayer. They claimed 50% loss of their bees, 50% loss of honey production. The smooth-talking lawyers from Bayer got it dismissed. The problems did not go away with this dismissal. In fact, in my own case, I've had over the years five official complaints with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture related to neonicotinoids killing my bees out in the field. The corn dust-off that was described by the farmer ahead of me. The lab results pointed clearly that neonicotinoids killed my bees in all five cases over these years that I had made official complaints. We can go back to file and you can check on that. MDA cited the facts that nothing could be done because there's a treated article exemption. Don't be deterred by the crop life types who insist that all chemicals are essential to agriculture. These are not, and case study after case study proves they aren't. Thank you.
Lee Helgen, Executive Director with Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We're the agricultural co-ops and retailers who would sell treated seeds to the farmer grower customers. Appreciate the opportunity to provide just a couple of comments today. We again believe that treated seeds are a very important tool available to farmers to ensure that we provide the crop protection necessary for these crops to have successful germination and grow, particularly in those early phases. As you know, treated seeds are treated as a regulated article, and we believe that there's good science-based approach to maintaining the availability of these seeds out there for our grower customers. I have with me today Ashley Runholt, who is a sales agronomist with the Cottonwood Co-op. She has some treated seeds. Can we pass those around?
They're in a container.
Don't. It's not often we get to bring props to the Ag Committee. You know, all the other commodity groups get to bring in food or ice cream or things like that. We have treated seeds. I guess it's not okay.
It's not ice cream.
Ashley.
Welcome, Ms. Runholt, and state your name for the record.
Ashley Runholt. I am the agronomy sales manager with Cottonwood Co-op Oil Company. It's the world's first oil co-op, so it's kind of our claim to fame down in Cottonwood, Minnesota. I am here to talk about a couple of different things for opposition of House File 3704. I am a proud mother of two kids, a proud wife of a farmer, and then the agronomy sales manager at Cottonwood Co-op Oil Company. Now, I do agree that there is room for improvement in everything that we do. First and foremost, our largest concern is the safety from both a human stand and a kid stand, because my children are around this. My growers' kids are around this. And in order for our family farm to continue being a family farm, my kids need to be safe and healthy and also want to farm, obviously, long-term. From an aspect of the current bill, the concerns that I have with it is more of the language. So the current language is systemic insecticides, which is not just neonicotinoids. It would also include nematicides, which is yield limiting. And there's a way that we could determine which ones that we would use in that need. The second concern that I have is from a parent of a farmer is the mental health aspect of if this bill passes. And that might sound a little foo-foo and a little far-fetched, but it's no surprise to anybody in this room that we're facing a down ag economy. There's lots of university studies that have came out that have already projected a high suicide rate increase based off of the current financial environment for our farmers. And this would impact them on a financial scale. Because of the bill's wording, it would need a third-party vendor to be hired in order to have the risk assessment done. And if the farmer needs the seed treatments every year, so an example, if we take neonics completely out of the equation and go just with systemic insecticide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carolyn Olson, and I farm with my husband on our Century Farm in Lyon County. We started our transition to organic crop production in 1998 and now farm all our land organically. We have an extended crop rotation growing corn, soybeans, small grains, and alfalfa. We also utilize cover crops on our small grain acres. In addition to farming, I serve as the Vice President of the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, representing over 30,000 farm and ranch families across the state. I'm here to speak in opposition of House File 3704. I want to start by saying that, as an organic farmer, I understand that many people have concerns about neonic seed treatments. I have chosen to farm under a different management practice that works for my farm. But I am here today because I also strongly believe farmers need the discretion to use management practices that work best on their own farms. Proponents of this legislation will argue that it gives farmers choice by allowing them to purchase non-treated seed. But the truth is, farmers already have access to non-treated seed. We sell conventional and organic seed for a Minnesota-based seed company. If our customers prefer untreated seeds, they simply need to order it early or request it ahead of time. The bill would not expand choice, it would limit it. As an organic farmer, I have made one set of choices for my own farm, and others make different choices based on the needs of their farm. That is how a diverse agriculture system works and what makes Minnesota agriculture strong. We should not set policy that suggests one production model be imposed on all farmers through state mandates. For these reasons, I respectfully ask the committee to oppose House File 3704. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. That was under 2 minutes. Darren Broughton, welcome. State your name for the record. Time, and then Chairman. Next up, Richard Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Darren Broughton, Executive Director of Minnesota AgriGrowth. I want to thank Representative Purcell for bringing this bill forward and having a discussion on it. Unfortunately, I'm here today to outline several concerns as the legislation as currently drafted. A lot of folks will talk about how this legislation builds on the compromise that was developed in New York by Governor Hochul, so much so that they have literally copied and pasted that bill in New York, in Minnesota, and in Colorado. Unfortunately, it fails to recognize that Minnesota is not New York, Quebec, or Colorado. Our soil, our weather, our climate are very different, as is the magnitude of our agricultural economy. Just take looking at our row crops in, for soybeans. Colorado has 10,000 acres, New York 370,000 acres. Minnesota has 7 million acres. Corn, New York 1.1 million, Colorado 1.5, Minnesota 8.5 million. When you add oats and canola and barley, Minnesota consistently leads in crop acreage over New York and Colorado. Assessing Minnesota's 25.3 million acres of farmland on approximately 65,000 farms every year will be a massive mobilization of third-party validators and state agency staff. The current approach, conducting, reviewing, and approaching these assessments, fails to give assurances to Minnesota farmers that they will purchase and plant their seeds in a timely manner. That's why copying and pasting a law from New York that has not yet been implemented fails to recognize the magnitude of Minnesota's economy, adversely impacts the economy, creates regulatory chaos, and a huge cost to Minnesotans, particularly for higher food, beer, and fuels. No, this is the reason why the Colorado Senate last week voted 5-2 against it.
Chair Hansen, Co-Chair Anderson, my name is Richard Severson. I'm currently serve on the Minnesota Corn Growers Board of Directors. I farm together with my family in Pope County near Clontarf, Minnesota. Together we raise corn, soybeans, hay, and sheep. I'm the fourth generation on my family farm, making my son and his kids the fifth and the sixth. After decades of dairy farming and feeding Holstein steers, we now have sheep of all sizes and shapes stuffed into our retired dairy facilities. I would like to share with the committee our concerns with HF 3704. Treated seed is an important tool for Minnesota corn farmers, providing early growing season protection from persistent pests like corn rootworm, wireworms, and seed corn maggots. These pests are endemic to Minnesota cornfields. They occur every year. That is why most corn seeds are purchased with the treatment already on them. Modern seed treatments are major improvements over tools used in the past. I'm experienced enough to remember when dumping a bag of seed corn into the planter generated a cloud of orange or pink dust containing toxic chemicals, or carrying bags of granular insecticide to the planter. These modern tools are measured active ingredients are measured in grams or fractions of a gram instead of pounds per acre. Since 2008, we have implemented many conservation practices on our farm. Our corn planter uses GPS to vary corn populations to match soil productivity and ensure that there's no overlap on the ends or sides of the field, ensuring no wasted seed. 4 years ago, I became water quality certified by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. In order to do that, I had to reduce tillage. Since then, we have been using vertical shallow tillage on all soybean acres. After 2 years of experimentation, this year all cornfields going to soybeans have a rye cover crop growing under a thick mulch of corn residue. Soybeans will be planted no-till into standing rye and then chemically terminated. We've also discovered that our sheep really enjoy grazing corn and soybean residue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Darren Johnson, and then followed by Bob Luck. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Chair Hansen, co-chair Anderson, fellow committee members, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Minnesota soybean growers. My name is Darren Johnson. I'm a fourth generation soybean and corn farmer from Wells, Minnesota, and I'm currently serving as president of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. First off, I want to talk about the benefits of seed treatment on our farm. Seed treatments reduce the overall pesticide use. Targeted protection seed treatments apply small, precise amounts of active ingredients directly to the seed, reducing the overall chemical load in the environment. Less spray passes, protecting young seedlings early, reduces the need for additional applications later in the season. And actually on our farm, our treated seed, so we run a little bit of both because we grow seed beans, so we have some that we call, like, they come in naked, so they're not treated. So we have had lots of side-by-side comparisons, and for the most part, we have not had to spray a post-pass for aphids with treated seed. This also supports conservation and stewardship and soil health. Many Minnesota farmers are reduced or no-till to improve soil health and reduce erosion. In a lot of cases, you would be planting in cooler soils in these situations. Also, generally speaking, Minnesota farmers are planting soybeans in cooler conditions across the state, no matter the practice. Reduced erosion and runoff. A well-established crop canopy made possible by a healthy seed reduces soil erosion, which is always a concern for water quality in Minnesota lakes and rivers. Avoids excess seed use, and that goes into replant, allows us to plant at lower rates. I'm going to
move on here and skip a little bit. Wet cool springs lead to disease like Pythium and Phytophthora, also Fusarium and Rhizoctonia. In total, four diseases alone are costing us 90 million bushels in yield loss. Let's not forget to mention cyst nematode and sudden death. Nematodes also causing a 10% reduction in yield. Also, the all-season-long insect suppression for pesky insects like aphids and bean leaf beetles, ultimately reducing yields and having to make more passes across the field without the use of seed treatment. I'll just quickly, technology has improved dramatically, especially with seed treatment. We are able to cover our soybean seed and corn seed with a coating that helps us reduce what we'd use for talc and reduces the dust.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Luck, followed by Kelsey Love Zaverda. Mr. Luck, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Bob Luck. I am the past president and a current board member of the Twin Cities chapter of Trout Unlimited. One of the best-kept secrets in the land of lakes is our world-class trout streams. Our chapter, with over 2,000 members, is one of the largest in the country. In the 12 years from 2011 to 2022, neonicotinoids were detected in 41 of 43 streams sampled at least 10 times by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Most of those streams regularly exceeded the EPA benchmark for chronic harm to aquatic ecosystems. Two of the most contaminated streams are the Root and Whitewater Rivers. These are the largest and most productive trout streams in Minnesota, and anglers spend all winter anticipating the Mother's Day caddis hatch. The last time I saw a large hatch was on the Whitewater in 2022. Rhizoforms covered the river, and rafts of caddis flies accumulated in the eddies. I have returned every year since then, and I've seen some sporadic emergences, but nothing like that magical hatch in 2022. I've heard countless similar stories from other chapter members about the recent dramatic declines in insect hatches. The food chain for trout and many other animals is collapsing while we watch. Most of our trout streams run through farmland. Thanks largely to the stewardship of Minnesota farmers, we have more miles of trout streams now than we did 30, 50, or 100 years ago. We want farmers to thrive, but evidence shows that neonic-treated seeds do not improve agricultural yields. HF 3704 will protect our waterways from these poisons in a way that works for our farmers. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Zavedra. I'm a farmer in Chisago County. I'm also the chair of our local cooperative. My journey into farming actually began with honeybees, so I started by taking the class at the U of M. I found a mentor, and eventually I found myself working hundreds of colonies, both in honey production and queen breeding on the Big Island of Hawaii. That is like one of the largest queen breeding operations in the world. So what bees teach you very quickly is that nothing on a farm can exist in isolation. Pollinators, soil life, crops, insects, they're all connected. And when you change one part of the system, the whole system responds. And that understanding has shaped how I farm. One of the challenges with neonicotinoid seed treatments is that they're often used automatically, whether a pest problem exists or not. Now, as a farmer, I believe that we should be making best management practices based on what's actually happening in the fields. It's kind of like wearing your snow boots in July, you know, like waiting for the snow. It's like, let's see what's happening and react accordingly. So farming landscapes are shared ecosystems. What happens in one field can affect the next. So farmers like me who are working to build pollinator habitat and ecosystems can be impacted by pesticide decisions happening feet just from my farm boundary. So when that happens, the burden often falls on me rather than the practices creating the risk. And so this bill gives MDA time to build a system that verifies when these treatments are truly needed. So that would be creating a fair framework for everyone farming in the same landscape. So I'm asking for your support for this bill from the perspective of someone who began farming through the lens of pollinators and ecosystem health. I really think this is a thoughtful and responsible step forward. So thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Right at 2 minutes. Serena Chainry, American Bird and Conservancy via Zoom, and then Commissioner Peterson and Mr. Stamper, if they want to get forward.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Proceed. Yes.
Serena Chainry on behalf of American Bird Conservancy in favor of this bill today. And I want to start by saying, since the 1970s, North America alone has lost roughly 3 billion birds. And I'm not talking about life cycle shifts. That is bulk population decline. And all it takes is one single neonicotinoid-covered seed to kill an entire songbird outright. And these are not just one-off instances from a bird digging up seeds, but prolific occurrences from large-scale ag seed spillages that often occur. And aside from these very lethal direct poisonings, there are countless sublethal effects such as impaired abilities to migrate or even reproduce. But the most impactful consequence from these systemic insecticides is food loss. These very harmful chemicals are non-discriminative. So in one vast swoop, we are decimating beneficial insect populations that our soil and our birds need to survive. But aside from advocating for birds, we are advocating for more freedom of choice for farmers. ABC actually has a program where we are paying farmers to experiment with using seeds not treated with neonics. We have several growers all over the country, including Minnesota, that are successfully growing with untreated neonic seeds for large-scale crops like corn, soybean, and wheat. And regulations such as this would very likely give more incentive to these large-scale seed distributors to provide seeds not treated with neonics, because as it stands, farmers are paying more for negligible to no benefits. I'll read straight from some studies from the Journal of Applied Ecology. We documented no benefit of the insecticidal seed treatments for crop yield during the study. From Purdue and the University of Wisconsin, economic analysis further showed inconsistent evidence of a break-even cost. So minimal to often. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 15 minutes left. We have another bill. If there is anyone else who wants to testify for or against the bill, they should come nearer to the table. Commissioner Peterson and Mr. Stamper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Tom Peterson, Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We do have some concerns of the bill as written. The first piece would be just the fiscal note and the fiscal impact as we're considering that. I think you have a copy of the fiscal note in your packet, hopefully. The other part is, really gets to Section 5 or the verification process. You know, this bill or this idea or some form of it has been around since 2018. And also like the rulemaking provision and how that would work and what it would do. And so talking to states like New York, I talked to my other commissioners that have are in the process of implementing this as it goes forward, we can see some of those pieces come forward. And so I worry about just the impact and how that would be on farmers. It's something that, you know, we could work on and other things. As I said, this has been in place since 2018. I wanted to just highlight some of the steps that that MDA has been working on in those cases. MDA has worked with, is working with pesticide registrants currently to obtain sales data for neonics treated with seeds to quantify the load. That major registrants have agreed to provide this data voluntarily. MDA expects to receive this data by April. MDA also monitors both groundwater and surface water resources throughout the state for over 180 pesticide-related chemical in hundreds of ag and urban watersheds. We do rarely see exceedances of water quality standards, but when we do, we follow a pesticide management plan. We also, following the pesticide management plan, and for example, in December of 2020, we have designated some neonic pesticides, including clothianidin and imidacloprid, Josh can correct me, as surface water pesticides of concern in Minnesota. When we do develop that, we develop specific BMPs and mandatory label requirements and a series of voluntary practices, as along as other things that we could mention, a series of things we're doing.
Just before, Mr. Is there anyone else who wants to testify? Mr. Stamper? It would be great if you didn't have any testimony so that we could take questions from the members. Co-Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, according to your testimony, you say seed treatments have no economic value. A couple testifiers said they don't improve yields. So how could there ever be a verification of need if they don't do any good?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Anderson. I believe that was my quote from the National Research Defense Council. And then that is, as they looked to Quebec, my assumption of why in 2 years, basically, Quebecois farmers are not using it is perhaps that very thing.
Co-Chair Anderson.
You didn't answer my question. If, in fact, there's no need to use seed treatment, how could there ever be a verification of need?
Representative Purcell.
Testifiers have said it doesn't do any good, it doesn't improve yield. You said there's no economic value. How could we ever get a verification of need from any ag commissioner to use seed treatment?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, co-chairs. I am not intimately familiar with the process that the agency used for verification of need, so we can ask commissioners about that process if I'm unable to answer that in great detail.
Representative Anderson.
Well, my point is, and we've heard this before, that it's like farmers are spending money on seed treatments just for the heck of it, that there's no value, and that's the furthest thing from the truth, that there is a value. It's like an insurance policy, if nothing else. We don't know for sure in the spring, when we buy seed in the fall, if we're going to need it. And so that's why I have a lot of questions about the timing of your bill. When would the farmer have to obtain this waiver to use seed treatment?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you to both chairs. I don't believe that's specified in this particular bill language, but I'm very open to conversations as I continue working on this. I don't imagine that this will be a 2026 priority, but I'm dedicated to continuing the work on it. So would love to talk about timing.
Okay. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So line 3.9, a person must not sell or distribute in the state or into the state, and then you go on to list all the different seeds that you want to prohibit here. So could a farmer buy treated seed in Iowa, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and bring it into the state, or does this prohibit that, or how does that work?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, my interpretation also on that line 3.9, it says must not sell or distribute in the state or into the state. So I believe that it's regardless of the state of origin of the seed. Could be Minnesota, could be any other states.
Representative Jacob.
Follow up, Chair Hansen.
Representative Jacob.
So how would you enforce that?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. I think that's part of the question, and at least the packet that I have, I don't have the fiscal note from the Department of Ag, but I did just get a glimpse at it. And so I believe that that's part of the question and what they're trying to figure out with what the cost would be then for the department to have that regulatory piece of it.
Just for the record, I don't think any of us got the fiscal note, so I anticipate it'll be coming. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So effectively a seed police of some sort would be required. But different question then. So your bill doesn't really prohibit neonics. I'm going to just use the word neonics because it's easier.
Yeah.
It only prohibits them as applied to seed, right? So if I have an insecticide box on my planter, and that's how we did it before we had treated seeds, we're just going to put this in the box now, run it down the furrow, and all of the weeds and everything are going to, we're going to use a tremendously much larger quantity to not put it on the seed where it was targeted previously. Your bill doesn't speak to any of that, right?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jacob, for the question. On page 2, lines 12 and 13, it also talks about not being able to apply or treat outdoor ornamental plants and turf. But as far as in the agricultural realm, I think we already have statute around that neonicotinoid use, not on seeds, but I might be wrong about that, Mr. Chair, if you know or if I can phone a friend.
I'm just looking at the clock, so
I'm happy to follow up with you and dig further into what current statute is and how neonics sort of larger.
Last follow up,
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Neonics are not the only way that this can be done. Previously, to treated seed, it would be diphenate insecticides, which were extremely toxic, which this got away from all that. But your bill certainly does not speak to that, which is what you would drive us back to, correct? That's what I would have to do. My planter still has a 1977 model planter, has insecticide boxes on it. We were so happy when we didn't have to use that dangerous chemical, diphenate, anymore.
Representative Purcell.
Drive us back to.
Thank you. Representative Jacob, I know better than to try to tell a farmer exactly how to do their job. And so I'm not going to tell you what you're going to put on your field or not. But we heard a lot about a lot of tools in the toolbox. We heard a lot about technology. So I think we can probably do better.
Representative Burkle for last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I won't even, since we don't have a fiscal note, I was going to ask Commissioner Peterson to come up quick and just give me a glimpse of what he would expect for FTEs to implement, in particular the pest risk assessment part of this bill and just the number of FTEs, maybe a rough idea. I have no clue what this would cost.
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, and my apologies, I thought you had the fiscal note. It's my understanding it's at the Legislative Budget Office, and you'll have it soon, so apologies on that. And my understanding also is that we would have about 4.5 FTEs to implement the program currently as it's written.
Yeah, good. I'm good. We got to go.
Representative Purcell to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to everyone who made their case for or against this bill. This is how we best do our job, and I thank you for doing it out in public. I'll close with NRDC's statement about House File 3704. It's a carefully tailored bill that limits neonic uses that are both harmful and unnecessary while preserving flexibility for farmers to use seed treatments that will address real pest problems. It's a win for pollinators, pollinator-dependent farmers and beekeepers, Minnesota's environment, and all Minnesotans who value clean water, local produce, and a healthy environment. When you know better, you do better. It's time for us to stop avoiding looking at this difficult issue and work together, of which I'm happy to do and extend that invitation to every person in this room, whether you testified or whether you have an election certificate or not. But it's time to take action so we don't have any more mysterious fish kills, mass pollinator extinction events, or epidemic levels of cancer and other diseases in rural America. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I renew my motion that House File 3704 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Next up, House File 3260, Representative Frederick, and you have a couple testifiers. If they can come forward as you are beginning to do the bill, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick moves House File 3260 to be laid over. And I believe you have a technical amendment, A1 amendment. Would you like to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I introduced this bill last year, so the amendment would just update the dates in the bill to forward 1 year is all.
Representative Frederick moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it. The bill is amended. Representative Frederick, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. In this, I'm going to kind of zoom out. Today we've been talking about like some of the things that we put in our soil, and this bill looks just to look at land use in general across the state. This year alone in this committee, I've heard from several different members from across the political spectrum where they say something to the extent of, in my community, I see this. In my community, I see this. We've heard from testifiers talking about fewer production acres across the state. What this bill aims to do is to take an approach of let's gather data. Let's see what the actual numbers are so we're not just relying on individual people's observations in their communities. While, I mean, that obviously has value too, this would give this committee a data point for us to make any, whatever that decision may be on any future bill, based on how land is being used, how much is being sold, and what is kind of being sold for. And with that, I would just wrap that up so we can turn it over to testifiers.
We have three testifiers, Taylor Olson with the Land Stewardship Project, and Schweigler with the Minnesota Farmers Union via Zoom, and Richard Severson from the Minnesota Corn Growers. If the testifiers that are here would please approach and so we can move. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Hi, thank you, Co-Chair Hansen. I'm Taylor Olson. I'm a beginning farmer in Taylor's Falls, and I'm here today to share my support of this bill on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project, an organization that I'm a member of, and also on their Land Access and Emerging Farmer Steering Committee. Thank you, Rep. Frederick, for bringing this bill forward during this critical time. For farmland preservation with growing consolidation and making sure that land access is available to folks who want to grow and to farm and grow food for our communities. We know that thousands, if not millions, of acres are set to exchange hands in Minnesota in the next 10 to 15 years as the farmers are either retiring or phasing out. And it's critical that Minnesota is looking into current land trends and creating recommendations for the future so that we can protect this farmland and supporting the next generation of farmers getting access to land like myself. We know that having financial and farming data helps the legislature to make the best possible choices to serve the farmers of Minnesota. And with the Emerging Farmers Office at work with the Department of Agriculture and our growing diversity among farmers, we ask that the MDA incorporate information on the demographics of the farmers in this study where it's possible. We are especially looking forward to the legislative recommendations ensuring that ag land is available to farmers and ask that stakeholders from farm orgs that serve small and mid-size farmers like Land Stewardship Project be included in this process, and any legislative recommendations that also suggest ways to combat the growing consolidation of farms and the influx of data centers buying farmland would be critical to address. Thank you.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Sorry, your audio.
Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Schweigel, and I farm in Browns Valley in Big Stone County in west central Minnesota. My husband, my father-in-law, and I run a diversified grain operation where we raise corn, soybeans, wheat, rye, and winter camelina. I also have the privilege of serving as the vice president of Minnesota Farmers Union. On behalf of both myself and our organization, I'm here to express strong support for Representative Frederick's bill to commission a report on agricultural land trends, HF 3260. When I think about my own journey into agriculture, the cost of farmland was and still is one of the biggest challenges. When my husband and I were starting out and transitioning into our family's operation, it was difficult to find land that we could afford that would allow us to expand enough to support another family on the operation. Now, as we work toward taking over even more of the operation, we're facing another familiar challenge: how to financially transition that land from one generation to the next. I know many of you understand this already, but it's worth saying why land ownership matters so much to farmers like me. Most of us aren't going to make a fortune raising small grains or camelina. Our farms don't come with a retirement plan. The promise of agriculture for many family farmers, including my own, is that over time we can build some equity and economic security through owning the land that we farm. If farmland prices are rising because my neighbors and I are competing for productive land based on what we can grow and sell, that's one thing, and I understand that. But if we're competing with investors who may live far away from Minnesota and have no real connection to farming or the land, that is a very different situation. I've even seen ads on Facebook and Instagram saying things like, invest in farmland, you'll get better returns than the stock market. I've certainly seen those and noticed them, and I find them concerning. This bill does not provide a specific policy solution. What it does is give us the information we need. Thank you.
Richard Severson.
Chair Hansen, since I've already introduced myself for the record, my name is Richard Severson. I'm here as a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I want to thank Representative Frederick for bringing HF 3260 forward. HF 3260 would give policymakers and the public a better picture of the direction of agricultural land use. Farmers, as we've heard, are often thinking about land access. While some farmers own a portion of their land, many are renting acres, and they're seeing prime farmland sold at prices out of reach, especially young and beginning farmers. Increasingly, this land is being sold to developers for non-agricultural use, including for housing development and large utility solar. Minnesota Statute 17.80 states that it is the policy of the state to preserve agricultural land and conserve its long-term use for food and agricultural production. It also states that we should minimize the use of agricultural land for energy production. Lawmakers recognize that agricultural land is a finite resource. We aren't making any more of it anytime soon, and we should preserve it. HF 32 would be a step in the right direction toward understanding the changes that are happening on Minnesota farmland and the pressures that farmers are facing accessing land, as well as the pressure that agricultural land is under that is removing it from being used for agricultural production. Thank you again, Representative Frederick, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Chair Hansen, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Is there anyone that has any questions that they could ask Representative Frederick after the meeting? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Like I said, this is just a data point for us to be able to reference in the future for any of our decision making. Thank you for the time.
Representative Frederick renews his motion that House File 3260 as amended be laid over. The bill is laid over. We are adjourned.